Welcome, sales enthusiasts, to another insightful episode of the Global Sales Leader Podcast, where we explore the dynamic world of sales, sales leadership, with your host, the experienced and knowledgeable Jason Cooper, which is myself. Each week, we bring you an engaging conversations with thought leaders and experts from the area of sales and sales arena and lots of areas around it, dissecting various topics in and around sales and sales leadership. This week, we have a privilege of sitting down with one of and only Keenan, a renowned sales thought leader, celebrated for his groundbreaking approach to sales known as gap selling. In this episode, Keenan and I share wealth of knowledge on critical thinking in the area of sales, the intriguing realm of artificial intelligence, and the keys of rising to the top 1% of the sales profession. You're going to enjoy this. Hello, good morning, good evening, and good afternoon. And wherever you are in this wide, wonderful, beautiful world that we live in, you are very welcome to the Global Sales Leader Podcast. I'm your host, Jason Cooper. So I'm always thrilled to have another exciting guest, and I plowed through the internet to try and find him. Eventually, I found Keenan, the author of Gap Selling, and we're going to have a look at all facets around gap selling. I'm always intrigued by a new methodology, a new way, and a new take to reach more customers and to get that buying decision. Yes. So, Keenan, rather than me talking about you and your experience and everything else, could you give us some little bit of a background of who you are and how you got into where you are right now?
Wow, a background. It, like anything else, is long, winding, meandering roads. I'll cut to the chase. I got here because I started selling later in life, late 20s, was really good at it, really good at it. Didn't know what I was doing. I just came naturally to me, right? Like an athlete. Some people are just naturally fast, naturally strong, whatever. I was just really good at it. So my career went really fast. I went from selling a $300 widget in 1997 to running a $325 million line of business with 125 salespeople scattered across the entire United States. So when that company started being pushed out by DSL, high-speed internet, because they sold the numbers for dial-up, I had a hard time getting another job because people were like, you're 32, you ran this giant piece of business, you've only got a resume that goes back 3 years, there was no LinkedIn at the time, you know what I'm saying? So I didn't like it. It bothered me. It was very difficult to stay there and continue. So my career sort of stabled out because my resume wouldn't support it. So in 2009, I said, screw this, and I started a blog. And I wrote every single day for 2 years on how to manage sales teams, run sales teams, hire people, processes. Like I just wrote about everything I was doing. And the idea was, all right, if I get a couple thousand people to read it regularly and I need a job in the future, I just go to the blog and say, hey, I'm looking for a new gig. And these people would have been following me, knew me, understood how I did things. So it was like I viewed it as an ongoing interview. You know what I'm saying? An ongoing interview for years.
Yeah.
What happened that I didn't expect is I started getting 20,000, 30,000 views. And then all of a sudden people started naming me top sales influencer, top sales blog, blah, 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 blah. So eventually then people started reaching out. My sales team is having problems. Can you help? Can you help? Can you help? And finally, I do some changes. I found myself with a choice. Go try to find another job or start this consulting firm. So I said, screw it. And I started going out on my own. And then after 8 years of doing that and coaching and teaching and leading and training, I started to see some trends. And that's when I started to write the book. And here we are.
Wow. I love that. And I like the process of going, well, should I get a job or should I just do this? And your gut process said, yeah, it's the right thing to do. And from what I've seen now is everyone's writing blogs and posts on LinkedIn and so on and so forth. And it does work. It's consistency, which is absolutely core to success. And if you keep on doing it and keep on doing it, you practice and practice until you get really good at what you do, which is what I love to do. Like, I'm quite curious now, because of last year, the sort of AI has really come into itself, as you know, like, it's been around for years anyway, but it's really everyone's doing ChatGPT and this, that, and the other. How do you think the 2024 is going to change with selling and selling practices? Because I will think, like, people, communication is absolutely core, especially for the next generation coming through. What's your take on that?
I don't like AI in sales right now. Not at all. Look, I'm being at a macro level. Do I think there are some use cases or applications at the micro layer for AI? Absolutely. Yeah. I think there's probably some good uses from a research perspective. I think there may be some good uses for some low volume or low, I don't know what the word is, but simple tasks, some simple type tasks. But I don't really concern myself too much with AI right now, because my belief system and my thesis on selling is that it is highly complex critical thinking. Yeah. And AI is not a critical thinker right now. AI requires very black and white data, and it'll start to manipulate that data and find trends. I can get behind that. You know where I think AI has the greatest chance to actually make a difference? Is in forecasting. Yeah, I'm sure someone's out there working on it now. I think the best place for AI in sales today is forecasting, because AI can take the finite data that sits in your CRM, and it can start to look for trends, right? That says, okay, I noticed that this is done, but this check, every time this is checked and this is done, for some odd reason, you get a 90% win rate. But when this is, okay, I can get behind that. But outside of that, as far as the actual selling process, look, there, no two sales are the same ever. I don't care if you're selling to the same size company, in the same town, the same product, for the same price, it's still not the same sale, because person A may have different outcomes or desired outcomes of different size problems, and person B have different ones. And there's no way AI can think like that. There's no way I can do that. There's no way that AI can process that information differently every time across whatever. So no, I'm not a huge fan of AI.
Yeah, it was just front of mind today, because I know there's a lot of people that hide behind technology. And okay, it's good for productivity. It's good for little hacks here and there. But really, selling is a one-to-one process. It's a human skill. It's getting over and picking up the phone and speaking to people. It's communication, effective communication 101, really.
A lot of people say, I just think that's an easy cop-out. I don't believe it's about communication. I believe it's about critical thinking. Okay, so yes, do you need to be able to communicate to do the critical thinking? But I think the communication is the highway, but I don't think it's the process. The process is the critical thinking. And that's what gap selling is all about. It's challenging salespeople to do the work up front. What is their current state? Physical, little problem, impact, root cause, et cetera. Excuse me, sorry. Right. So what is their, and then from that, where do they want to go? And what's preventing them from going there? And why do those root causes exist in the first place? And how does that translate into downstream negative effects to the organization? What happens if they don't change? All of that requires critical thinking. It challenges the buyer to critically think. It's supposed to bump those up to other priorities. There's so much going on that I think that's why a lot of salespeople aren't good at it, because you got to be really freaking smart. Yeah. And AI is not that smart yet. And it will be someday. I'm convinced of it, unfortunately, but not for a while. So it's not even just about communication. It's about critical thinking and problem solving.
Yeah, I agree. And there's different types of people. And from what I found, the analytical people are really good at the critical thinking. Yeah. Like you're like those back in the 1980s, those flashy guys, and they have all those typical sort of sales methodologies that you'd know from the 1980s. But everything's changed, really. The analytical thinkers are the ones that will really understand people and unpack the layers until they get to the core of the issue, the challenge, what it actually might be, as opposed to these flashy little techniques, which I don't think I don't think that works really. No. And it's so out of date. So when we have a look at, because I love having a look at all the different ways of doing things. Solution selling is another thing that I've looked into with Mike Bosworth, who I've had on my show as well. Love that. But I like some of the principles that you shared within your book. And I like the something that you said about not everyone has to be likable, but you have to be credible with what you do. And I know Robert Cialdini, one of the laws of influence and persuasion, you have to be likable. But I suppose if you're credible with that, but I want to have your take on that, because I think trust, credibility, knowing your stuff, but also know more about the customer than they know about themselves, and the impact that you can give. But I'd like to have your take on that, especially from what's written in your book.
Yeah. So everybody thinks about likability, and it's just not. I think they're conflating likability with trust. Okay.
Yeah.
In defining likability is also difficult. How do we define if you like somebody, right? Like, I like you, but I just met you. You know what I'm saying? So, right. So does better yet, I don't like you. I don't dislike you. Right. Yeah. And I expect the same. Maybe over time we start to like each other or not like each other. But most of the time it's in a neutral space. It's like, seems like a nice guy. How many times do you hear someone say, seems like a nice guy, but we don't know. But what we got to understand is when it comes to buying and getting someone to make a change or to do something with us, is their current environment has to be untenable. They have to be unhappy. The current environment has to be untenable, intolerable, frustrating, and they have to come to a place that says, I don't want to be here anymore. Okay. Mm. The only way you sell somebody something is if that person or that organization comes to the conclusion that what they're doing now, where they're sitting now, the results they're getting now, the environment they're in, can no longer exist. They just can't stay there anymore. Okay. And so therefore the only way or the best way to get somebody to recognize that and to help them with that change is if they perceive you as having information, skill sets, ideas, concepts, or whatever that can help them make that change as efficiently and as effectively and as successfully as possible. So likability doesn't play a role in that. The key element in that process is credibility. Do I believe you, Jason Cooper, have the skill sets, have the knowledge, have the understanding, have the awareness, have the expertise, right? Have the tools to get me out of this situation and can help me. And the more credible I believe you are, the more knowledgeable you are, the more credible you are, the more I will trust that you can get me out. And if I trust that you can get me out and I believe you can do it better than anybody, I'm going to go with you regardless of the fact of whether or not I like you.
Yeah, yeah. And on the back of that, like, the internet's such a powerful tool now. They know about you before you even meet them, you know. There's so much stuff about websites that, like, let's forget about that. Like, if you want to send it, if you have a deck, send it in advance so they can read it before the meeting. Like, you don't have to go with a deck. Like, they can find out everything about your company. There's so much is being lost with these bullshit types of conversations when you meet people, because they already know about your company. Yep. They don't want to know about that. They want to know, what can you do to help their pain? What value can they give you? Mm-hmm. And some of the things, you just need to do a lot of due diligence behind that. LinkedIn like to say deep selling, which is find out as much as you can about the client. Look, there's so much data out there. You can do the research and due diligence before you meet the client and have ideas about their pain points, but not really know until you ask them some really good questions and keep asking them questions after question. And I love the way that you applied, and I think this continuous learning. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that I do all the time, and I'm sure you do it, like, by reading books. I read loads and loads of books because if I get an idea that's going to help me and propel me to go forward, that's what engaged me about your book. And that's what I liked about it. And I'm going to borrow quite a bit off that as well. Thank you very much, Keenan. I like that. So I always think people's mindset behind, do they want to do it? Have they got the passion? Have they got the purpose, rather than just being a job? And I think part of this is having that personal impact, that you do want to make a difference and make a change. Always like to have a point based on you as well, because you come across extremely successful, incredible, because you've got that lovely book there. But what else have you done? Because I'm always curious by that.
What have I done?
Things have you done? Because there's obviously some intrinsic motivation inside of you that's actually propelled you to go forward to make sure that you've have been successful in the past. I always like to know what that passion was.
I don't know. I mean, I don't even know if I'm answering your question with this, but I have this innate drive that I'm not going to, if I'm going to do something and I'm going to commit to it, I'm going to be the best at it possible. So, and if I can't find the time to be the best at it, I'm not going to do it. Okay. So an example is I got into golf late in life. I got golf as an adult. I think I was 27, 28, 29 or something when I started golfing. And I hated it as a kid. Like, I think I went once or twice. It's stupid, slow, it's boring. I hated it. But as an adult, at about 28, I started like, ooh, you get one clean hit down the middle. I'm like, ooh, that was fun. Yeah. So right around that time, I said, okay, I like this game. And so I wanted to beat all my – it's probably the competition to me. I wanted to beat all my friends. I wanted to be able to hit it 300-plus yards all the time. I wanted to get into the 70s. So I had all these goals. Like, I want to be a good golfer. So I would golf with the friends on the weekends, but I was the only one who would go to the driving range. I'd go to the putting. I'd get new clubs. So all of a sudden I started, practicing and getting good. And I got down to about a 12. And then I got married and I'm a skier. That's my favorite thing now. And the ex didn't like it. I'd spend a whole day skiing in the winter. I couldn't in the summer. Then spend a whole day. Like, we had three young kids. I was like, this is not going to fly. So I stopped doing it. And I don't do it anymore because I'll go up once in a blue moon for a bachelor party. But the point being is because I can't commit to being good at it every day, I don't do it. I just don't do things half-assed. I'm going to do it and be the best at it, or I'm not going to do it. So the point is, with my job, I found selling, I found sales, and I found leadership, and I like doing that stuff, and I enjoy it. So I did everything I could to be the best at it. I'd read about it. I'd practice it. I'd pay attention. I blogged. And so I just became a student. And then as a student, I became, I don't want to say a master, but I just put all my time into being as good as I can. So, I think really the lesson there for everybody is if you're doing something and your objective is not to be the best that you can and or better than everybody else, stop fucking doing it. I don't know what to tell you. Just stop. Do something else.
Well, that really did answer my question, actually. And I just wanted to find out what motivates you to do what you do. And I think
to be the best. Whatever I do, to be the best. I want to be the best.
You want to be the best. And the top 2% of the 2% in the world, they're the people that have that particular mindset to actually have that passion, the self-accountability, rather than waiting other people to do it for you. That's why you get all these fluffy companies that go, well, go into that course. And then you get half the participation of people not turning up and go, well, they're not self-accountable for their own actions. And something that I like to say is just go off and read a book, go off and go to a course, do something to learn to be the best that you possibly can. Because otherwise, you're just going to be one of these people, no, I'm not going to turn up to that.
Yeah, nobody likes that. Nobody likes that. Look, I have this thing called the Be a One Percenter.
Yeah.
I was wearing it in L.A. once. This woman laughed because I love your shirt. And I think she thought I meant a one percenter from, the U.S. money perspective.
Oh, okay.
What I mean by a one percenter is if you can be the top 1% of your career or your profession, then you're going to be successful, whatever you do. And that is achievable. Being the 1% in a profession is achievable. Yeah. So you figure if there's, depending on who you ask, it's between 7 and 10 million or 7 and 14 million salespeople in the United States or the world. So let's just go with 7 million in the world, right? If you're the top 1%, you only have to be one of 70,000. That seems achievable to me. One of 70,000? Yeah. I could be one of 70,000 of something. You know what I'm saying? Same thing with skiing. Skiing is my passion now. And I am absolutely 100,000% know for fact I'm in the top 1% of all skiers in the world. Now, I'm not a competitive skier, right? But they make the top 1% of the top 1%. You know what I'm saying? But as I go out on that lit thing and I see 100 people, I'm better than 100. I'm better about 500. Maybe probably better. It's times I'm probably one of the best 10 people, 5 people on the entire fucking mountain.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So it is achievable is my point. If you pick something that you love from work, hobby, whatever, and you say, I'm going to be in the top 1%, that's a win. Like, that's success. That's commitment.
I totally concur with that. That's why I do mountain running. And I did an ultra marathon last year. The first time I ever set a goal like that. And I went, I'm going to do 50K, which is 31 miles, but I'm going to do it over mountains. And I'd never run a marathon before.
That's crazy.
So this year I have a bigger goal, but I want to be the best that I possibly can, as much as my body is built for doing it, but I want to be the best that I can. I did break my ankle last year and I did something else to it. But in my head, I want to be back at it as quickly as I can. And again, in sales or sales leadership, it's no different.
No.
What can you do to be the very best at what you do? So the question I always like to ask, Keenan, is if you are interviewing you, what sort of questions would you ask you?
I've never had to think about that before. Never. I would probably ask the same questions I ask of everybody else, right? So I would ask myself, what is my thesis or what is my philosophy around sales? What am I interviewing for?
Global sales leadership.
Okay. Yeah. So I would ask me what my leadership style and approach is. I would ask me to share any processes or methodologies or anything I've created over the years. And watch this. This is one people, no one does this. If you're in a leadership position and you're coming to work for me, I'm asking you, what are some of the processes or methods that you created in some of your past positions that helped you succeed? And if they don't have any that they created, that's a massive red flag for me. Because that means the company gave it all to them, which means they didn't actually bring any value. They were just a cog. You see what I'm saying? Now, they may have been a good leader. They may have people to like them. But if they're not creating shit in their position, that makes me nervous, right? Because I could show you mountains of processes and methods and templates and things that I created in my position to make that job better. I would ask them, how they look at, or once they told me their thesis on leadership, then I would ask them, how did they apply that? Or how did they execute on that thesis of leadership? Because when you're talking about a head of sales or a CFO or head of HR, head of anything, first and foremost, it's about leadership. That's more important to me than how they, their knowledge of HR or how they executed some HR activity, right? Or where they worked before. I don't give a shit about any of that. I want to know how you lead. Because when the minute you say leader, your job is to get people to do the work through them, right? You can't do the work. You can't go in there and start selling. You got to figure out how you structure it, how you hire people, what you look for, what processes you implement, what visions do you set, how do you move an organization of people? Mm-hmm. So all of my questions are around how do they do that before I ask questions about, well, tell me where you've been and tell me about your last job and tell me about, no. I want to know the thinking behind what you do. So I would ask myself all of those types of questions.
I love that. That's a really good answer for a complicated. Any other things that you might ask yourself? Because I'm always curious because I want to find out and pull out your expertise.
What's my biggest failure? I ask that all the time. What's your biggest failure?
Yeah, go on then. What's your biggest failure then?
I have a whole bunch, man. So I would probably talk about any one of the businesses I started before this. I might talk about this one called Create Buzz. It's a long story, so I'm not going to bore you. But it's a SaaS company that I started back in the mid 2000s, like 2005, 4, 6 in there. It was a really cool application. I got some advice from a VC, and I didn't listen to it. And if I had, I'd probably be in a very different place right now. So that was one I'd probably talk about. I talk about all the businesses I started and I failed. That's what I would talk about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it's good to have and be honest about them as well, because like we've all had failures.
Oh God. Yeah.
But it's all how we've learned from them and maybe what we're going to do slightly differently. That I know Marshall Goldsmith talks about feed forward. It's what you learned, where you are now, just don't do it again. How are you going to apply it differently next time? And how you're going to change the way you do things?
I have a saying that says maximize your failure ROI.
If you're going to fail,
you might as well get as much out of that failure as possible. Right?
Yep. Fail forward. That's what I always like to say. Fail it again. The only way we can grow and learn is by failing. Like, we do it every day. And I think the more honest you are with yourself and the more that you understand yourself, rather than just having that failure in your head going, oh, no, I'm not worthy, I'm not this, that, and the other, go, well, what can we do to just change it for the future? So probably when you started gap selling and when you put pen to paper of your methodology, I'm sure you had some sort of structure there. Or did you?
Yeah. So gap selling kind of happened by accident. I didn't set out to write a book. Like I told you, I had been running a sales consulting firm for quite some time. And I was constantly asked, do I do sales training? And I said, no. And they said, why not? And I said, because I'm not going to do the same stupid, boring sales training everybody else does. Yeah. So I'm not going to repackage other people's shit. So I just did the consulting piece, right? And then it was over the years as I would be coaching. So I would do consulting for organizations. And then part of that consulting, I'd have to go in and coach the salespeople or assess their pipelines or assess the salespeople themselves or help them get deals in stock or do deal reviews, whatever. And I would be doing these and I would see trends or I'd see something happen. Just stop. And I'd get up and I'd write something on the whiteboard. And then I'd sit back down. I'd be like, ooh, that was good. And I'd take a picture of it and I'd store it or I'd go and write a blog about it that next day. So by the time I got around to to writing the book, I had approximately 1,200 blog posts. Wow. I had constant notes from all my different engagements with people. And there was one particular whiteboard session that would be Eureka. Now, I don't believe in Eureka, generally speaking, but there was that trigger point that got gap selling going. And there was a gentleman who sold for one of my clients, and we would do deal reviews every Monday. And I'd ask him, he'd say, these are going to close. I'm like, okay, why is this one going to close? And he would say, oh, blah, blah. Well, what's the problem? And he'd say, oh, they have distributed systems. And I'd be like, okay. And then we'd ask a bunch of other questions. Then the next opportunity would come up. And I asked, what's the problem? And he said, they have distributed systems. And all of a sudden I started seeing this ain't fucking, no. Like, he kept using the same statement all the time. And I got frustrated. I said, no, this is not how this works. So I got up and I said, listen, I want to know what's going on today. Yeah. So I wrote current state or current something. I was like, what's happening today? Right. And I said, I want to know, like, and I wrote down all the things that could be happening. And then I said, and now that, because this is happening and they're pissed off, where do they want to go? And I wrote down where they want to go. And then I said, all the things that could happen. I said, it's your job to uncover what is happening, why it's negative, blah, blah, blah. And then where they want to go. And then I was like, so when you're done with that, you'll have this gap. That gap is why they're going to buy. Right. And that was all impromptu. I said, so for every conversation here, you got to tell me what the gap is. And then I took that home, looked at that, and then boom, everything went from there.
Eureka, that Eureka moment. I love that. Mm-hmm. And when you started that blog, was there any idea behind the blog, or just wanted to do something different?
The idea was to build an audience, to build reach so that next time I needed a job, I didn't have to work so hard. The idea was I'm blogging and then all of a sudden I say, oh, I either want to leave my gig or I get fired or I get laid off, whatever. I could say, hey, y'all, you've been reading my blog. I'm looking for a new gig. Anybody interested? Anybody know anybody? The idea was that I have an audience who could have found it for me. That was the only idea in the beginning.
Love it. And I'm always curious about giving people lots of golden nuggets. And I think you've done that already. But one piece of advice that you could have actually given yourself back in the day when you first started the book and first started with your own bit of business, a bit of a holistic question. What advice would you give yourself now?
Give myself back then?
Yeah.
Nothing. I did it all right.
Seriously. You did all right.
I did it all right. Like, look, I made mistakes.
Yeah.
Right. But I was on the right track. Starting the blog was a very smart decision. Doing it every single day for 712 days. The consistency for 2 years was critical. Yeah. building processes that allowed me to write good blog posts is what I built a feed of all of these other sales bloggers and all these other people that wrote about sales, et cetera. And if I got stuck, I'd go read that feed and then I would, ooh, that's a trigger, or I'm going to argue that. Or so it helped me keep the content going on the days that I didn't have time. Yeah. And I was like traveling, or I taught myself how to provide value in like five senses. And I learned that from Simon. What's the guy with the glasses? He was huge in the mid 2000s. Bald. Not Simon.
Brian Tracy.
He's a marketing guy. He did the Purple Cow.
Simon Sinek.
No. Oh. Not Simon. He did Purple Cow. He did. He's a marketing guy. He has an orange background. Wears glasses. He's bald.
I can't think of his name.
Oh, it'll come to me in a second. Anyway, he was really good. He had a really popular blog at the time. And I learned how to, like, in three or four sentences, provide value or questions. So those filled the days that I knew I couldn't do a huge format. So my point in this long diatribe is I was very deliberate. I was very deliberate. I was very thoughtful. And in spite of the mistakes, that is, honestly, this period of time over the last 15 years has been some of the places where I've made the best decisions, was the most consistent. And so there's nothing that's jumping out at me that would say I'd go back and tell myself. I'm sure if I watched a movie, it's like, ooh, don't, you shouldn't have done that. But that, the way I process that question about tell yourself means that I saw something looking back I shouldn't have done. And it's just in that period of time, no. I'm just happy with how it went. And
the good thing is that you got to where you are now. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's always lumps and bumps in the road. So how can people find out more about you, Keenan?
Try.
Hence me. That's what I did to you.
You just put in Keenan and I'm all over the place. And if you put in Gap Selling Keenan, you can't miss me. So I don't know what to say. You go to salesgrowth.com. There you, how's that? You got that right there. Salesgrowth.com. Or you can find me on LinkedIn, Keenan. If you want to find me, you can find me. It's not hard.
I think like anything, if you want to get hold of anyone in the world, and especially if you're into selling, you can get hold of them. There's always ways and means to get hold of people. That's why I like to reach out to people like yourself, because I think it's good to understand other people's successes. And for the audience, is to take some of the points that you've said about the 1% of the 1% and what it takes to be consistent, be self-accountable for your own actions, go from failure and move forward, get over yourself and be the best that you possibly can. That's what I've taken out of it today. And I think how you've put it into practice, especially against your personal life with your sporting life. And I think there's a congruence there.
Look, I think that I think the thing that makes me sad about life is that most people just don't take ownership for their life.
Yeah.
And because of that, they don't get the most out of it. And it's not just people who commit crimes or get stuck in dead-end jobs. I see in every aspect of life, I see highly successful men and women who have horrible marriages, who don't have relationships with their kids because they didn't take ownership for that piece. They didn't think about what it meant to be a parent. They didn't think about the type of relationship they wanted with their kids. They didn't stop and say and put in the work and effort to say, this is the outcome I want. And so therefore, this is what I'm going to do. And oh, by the way, this is what it's going to take. And these are going to be the challenges. And they didn't do it for their career. They didn't do it for their marriages. They didn't do it with their parents. They didn't do it with their children. They didn't do it with anything they love. They didn't pursue their passions. They didn't take ownership. And then we all wake, well, not me, but most people wake up and they're like fucking miserable.
Yep.
And then what they do is they try to pretend they're not. And they try to spin this facade, this veneer that they're not, and they deny it to themselves. But you see it in their reaction to political events. You see it in their reaction to other people. You see it in their reactions to their bosses. You see it in their reactions to how they get their job. You see it in their reactions when people criticize them or challenge them or suggest they have a problem. They built this whole veneer, and they know underneath it, it's nothing but fucking garbage that they just become vicious and angry and lash out. It's the whole thing is a shit show.
Yep.
And it's simply because they wouldn't stop and take ownership about who they are and what they want and accept who they are, what they want, and just own their life. And it's sad.
But you're absolutely so true. That is so true. The more you understand yourself, the better that you can control yourself. And then the better that you can actually go, well, this is what I want to do. Yeah. This is where I want to see my life. It's only I've actually taken control of my life. I love what I do now. Mm-hmm. It did take a little bit of a few hurdles. And I fell over so much, but I just got back up and say, well, I'll have to go into that direction. This is what I want to do now. So exactly like yourself. It's a bit of a Zig Ziglar quote is connect your passion to your purpose, to your dream. I think that's something that I like to live by because I think it's just so true.
100%, 100%. And that ownership comes in because I think a lot of people understand that their passion isn't always going to line up with what their parents expected of them, what they thought or what they think the world thinks they should do. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, I mean, it's a horrible metaphor, but you know, I think a lot of us sometimes can have skill sets in areas that we don't like. So I've always been very athletic. I joke all the time. I'm one of the most athletic people in the world who was never world-class in one thing. I was that kid in gym class who was best at everything. You know, when you put me in a sport, I was good at it, but I was never world-class in one thing. Right. So one of the things I was really, really good at was middle distance running. Like, fucking hated it. It was nothing. Running that 400, I was like, I'm not doing the 800. You'll be great at it. I'm like, no, I'm not touching it. I hate it. But you're really good. I'm like, I don't care. I don't care. So I'm sure there are people who have moved through life and they're really good at something. They don't like it, but they felt compelled to keep going because they're good. People said you should, et cetera. And that's the minute they lose control of their life.
Yeah. You got to do what's good. You got to definitely got to do what's good for you and how you feel about doing it.
Yes. And take the sacrifices. If you're really good at art and you want to do art, fucking do it. And that if you can't drive a Mercedes, fine. Don't drive a Mercedes. Me down the road. If you stick to it and you get good, you may. But you just can't have everything, right? Just do what you love and you will be happy. Own your life and you will be happy. But if you're doing life because you want the house, the car, the wife, the husband, the trips, and that's your motivation, you will wake up someday and think, what the fuck happened?
Yeah.
I'm miserable.
Yep. And you have to make sure that, number one, at the end of your life, that you're happy with what you've done. You can look back down your timeline because you do reflect when you're older and say, well, you know, if I did some fantastic stuff and I impacted thousands of people or I didn't and I just did my job rather than what I dreamed, what I love to do, what I aspire to do, how I'm happy about it. So you have to do what's happy for you. And this is one of the core things about this podcast today. And I think you've actually hit the nail on the head is do your life with passion and purpose to yourself.
Yeah. Every piece of it, every single piece of it. That's the people, every piece, not just your job, not just your hobby, but your parenting, your spousing, everything. Do it with a passion.
That's absolutely been awesome today. And I do appreciate the last 40 minutes of this podcast show, lots of key points along the way. And we'll share the notes and we'll share the podcast throughout all the social platforms as normal. Thank you so much for being my guest on the Global Sales Leader podcast. I really appreciate it.
You got it. Peace.
As we wrap up this enlightening episode of the Global Sales Leader podcast, we want to express our gratitude to Keenan for sharing invaluable insights on critical thinking and so much more, and the intricate dance of sales dynamics. We hope you, our listeners, have gained much inspiration, wisdom from this conversation as we have. Before we part, let's announce as we dive into the wealth of knowledge that our esteemed host, me, Jason Cooper, brings you to the table. Jason is not only an experienced thought leader in the realm of sales, but also dedicated advocate for the continuous learning and professional growth. To uncover more of Jason's expertise, stay updated with the latest trends in sales and leadership, be sure to visit his website, jasoncooper.io. There you'll find a treasure trove of resources, articles, perhaps even opportunities to engage with Jason Cooper directly. Whether you're a seasoned sales professional or just starting your journey, Jason's insights and guidance can undoubtedly steer you towards your success in the ever-changing landscape of sales and sales leadership.